Hi, I'm Jeffrey Baer from WTTW. You are listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Corrane.
Jimmy Corrane's a nerd. Jimmy Corrane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corrane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corrane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored by the Houston Improv Festival. Submissions are now open for the Houston Improv Festival through January 31st. This year, the festival is at the brand new, state-of-the-art Midtown Arts and Theater Complex in beautiful Houston, Texas. In addition to great shows, workshops, and after parties, there will also be a pub crawl and other fun events at uniquely Houston destinations. I went last year, and I had a great time. It is a great improv community and a great festival. And this year's festival is April 28th through May 1st, and submissions are only $25. To submit, all you need to do is go to HoustonImprovFestival.com/submissions. That's HoustonImprovFestival.com/submissions. And we are also sponsored by Mick Napier's great new book, Behind the Scenes, Improvising Long Form. Now, Mick Napier is the founder of the Annoyance Theater, and he has just released his brand new book, Behind the Scenes, Improvising Long Form. Now, this book talks about the complexities of long form and gives you tips on how to make it more accessible to non-improv audiences. Also, his first book, Improvise, Seen from the Inside Out, was recently re-released with two new chapters. Both books are on sale at the Annoyance Theater in Chicago or online at Amazon.com. And don't forget to check out my award-winning improv classes and workshops here in Chicago, the Artist Low Comedy. Registration is now open for my summer intensives. My summer intensive Artist Low Comedy is happening in July and August. For more information and to register, all you have to do is go to my slick new website at jimmycorrane.com. That's jimmycorrane.com. Guess what we have for you today? You took the words right out of my mouth. Yes, we have another great episode of Improv Nerd for you. Our guest today is Jeffrey Baer. He is a producer and a host on public television here in Chicago, and he is an icon here in this city. In terms of public television, you can't get anyone bigger here in Chicago. He's as well-known as Charlie Rose. He's well-known as Oscar the Grouch or Big Bird or any of the Sesame Street characters when it comes to public television. He's not only a producer, but he is also a host, an on-air host. He has an extensive television background, but what interested me most and why we had him on the show is he has an extensive improv and theater background. He taught at the Players Workshop of the Second City, which was where I studied, had my first improv class. He also got a theater degree at Northwestern University and is a big comedy and improv fan. Now, I like to do these episodes every once in a while. I call them the wild card episodes. We've had people like Rick Bayless, who was a celebrity chef on. We've had Jeff Hoover, who was a television producer. We've had Colt Cabana, who was a wrestler. And how they take their improv background and apply it to the non-traditional. They're not looking to be on Saturday Night Live, but how they apply it to their specific art. We talked to him about growing up and his father's love for comedy and how that influenced him, how he threw himself into theater and eventually got a master's from Northwestern University, and his first exposure to improv, and how he ended up teaching at the Players Workshop of the Second City, which, incidentally, is where I first started taking classes back in the 80s, believe it or not. Before we get to the episode with Jeffrey, I just want to say the good news continues here. As you know, Lauren is pregnant, and we found out over the holidays, which were very long, that we are going to be having a girl. So I'm really excited about that, and I'm also relieved because I feel like with a girl, there's less to screw up than if we had a boy. And then when we got back, we went to Babies R Us, which is this huge baby store, and they have, like, you know, baby furniture and baby clothes and anything that a baby needs to be a baby, really. And I just didn't realize as we were walking through the aisles, you register, you get to register stuff that people hopefully will give you at these baby showers. But there was so much stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, I was overwhelmed. There's so much stuff that babies need, you know? And we haven't officially announced it on Facebook yet, so you guys are kind of getting, like, inside information, kind of an exclusive here as listeners to the podcast of Improv Nerd, you know, because... Lauren feels like once we make the announcement, we should be taking a picture, because when you take a picture on Facebook, it does much better in terms of likes, in terms of responses, than if you just put text. So we're kind of waiting to get the perfect picture with me and Lauren and something funny with the baby. So she feels that once that hits Facebook, that we are going to get a lot of gifts. People are just going to send us gifts. And actually, it brings up a really good point for you, the listener here. You guys are, you know, if you want to start right now, you got a head start before anybody on Facebook if you want to send baby gifts. And I'm sure, you know, if you go online, we're registered at Babies R Us. It probably is no problem finding the name Corain, Lauren Corain. I think it's under Lauren. It wouldn't be under my name because, you know, when it comes to baby stuff, they don't care about the guy. I know that sounds awful, but I think it's true. Enough about me. You're going to love this episode. Here it is, the Jeffrey Bayer episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Now, I got to say this. We look alike. Right? A lot of people say that. You know what? More people say to me, this is what they'll say to me. They'll go, aren't you on channel 11?
Really?
Yes. And sometimes I'll say like really out there things. And I'm like, oh my God, I hope I'm not getting Jeffrey Bayer in trouble. Has anyone thought that you were me?
Honestly? Or
honestly,
should I?
This is about being honest.
Yeah. No.
Okay, great. I'm glad we got that. Now you
because they only hear you on the radio.
Right, when I was on the radio.
When you were on the radio.
Oh, I was so good at that.
You were?
Yeah, yes. So you grew up in Highland Park and Deerfield, Illinois.
Yes.
10 years old, you moved to Deerfield. Your mother was a grade school art teacher, mm-hmm. and your father was an accountant.
True.
But at home, your parents were very musical and would write song parodies for parties. What kind of influence did that have on you?
A big influence. So my dad was the one who wrote the song parodies. My mom was music, and she was an art teacher, a grammar school art teacher. And my dad was, you know, a businessman, but that's, you know, that was what he did to make money. It clearly was not what he loved, mm-hmm. you know. So, he had a real way of sort of seeing everything as a setup for a punchline, mm-hmm. you know, which is maybe not the greatest thing when you're a child, but...
What was his sense of humor like? Was it kind of schmaltzy?
Oh, corny.
Okay, all right.
So, like, grown. There's nothing, you know, the groaner is...
Would you, like, roll your eyes it was that bad and be embarrassed
It was only when I became an adult that I realized that.
Okay.
I mean, as a kid, I thought it was extremely funny. I still think it's pretty funny. Mm-hmm. And they're, by the way, they're still around. My dad is just turned 95. And my mom just turned 87, and knock on wood, they're doing
great. Are you superstitious?
A little bit.
Okay.
About that, I am.
Okay. Your grandma, I like you, because you're so much, how much, when you said that, I'm thinking there's a guy who does the tours on Channel 11.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was just kind of I just wanted to share that with you.
Okay. Okay.
Your grandma said that you'd be on television one day.
Yes. I love this story.
Could you tell us?
Can you tell that he pre-interviews? He had someone else called me and asked me all these questions.
But don't you do research. You just don't go out to, like, Graceland Cemetery and just go, well, there's a tombstone here. You do some research.
No, it's true. It's true. I'm just saying it's impressive.
Thank you.
No,
I didn't know that was a compliment. Thank you. All right. I have a hard time taking compliments.
It's okay, Jim.
Thank you.
Until I found theater in high school, right? I mean, I don't have much of a sense of kind of what, kind of who I even was up until I kind of walked into drama club my sophomore year of high school. But I was, where the story comes from is that I was much younger. I must have been like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. I guess I must have been sort of funny or theatrical, because I remember my grandmother with her Yiddish accent. I must have said something, I don't know what, but she got down right in my face and she said, "You're going to be on television someday." And I didn't, it wasn't like a compliment. It was like a prophecy. You know, I was like, gee, I wonder what I'll be doing on television someday. You know, I mean, honestly, it just felt like, oh, I'm going to be on television someday.
And that really, that was like an affirmation, or really was support for you.
I don't even know if I took it that way. I mean, I just took it as like, grandma says I'm going to be on TV. I wonder what I'm going to be doing.
But you also said you didn't have a lot of friends growing up, and you spent most of your time drawing cartoons.
Well, there was a period of time. When I was a little kid, you know, you have all the friends in the neighborhood. Actually, one thing I do remember is that my next-door neighbor, Beth Deaver, are you out there? who was in third grade when I was in first grade. I don't know why I'm thinking of this. But, you know, my friend was, I was a boy and she was a girl, which is odd, right? And she would come over with her little sister, Dee Dee, whose name I just remembered, and she would play with my brother and me. And she'd go, "Okay, we're going to play house." You know, I'd be like, "Okay." And she goes, "Okay. My name is Martha Jones. I'm wearing a blue skirt and a green shirt. I have blonde hair with a thing in my hair." You know, I'd be like, "What? Like, what? Why do you care about what you're wearing?" It was like so bizarre to me that, you know, that she would like care about all this. And I don't think we'd ever actually get to the game. You know, just be like, "Can we start playing now?" "No, no, no." And then I've got a dog named Snoopy, and he's purple, and he's got a little fur and his diamond collar. I'm like, "When are we going to start the game?" But anyway, no. So later on, I in junior high, I was kind of a bullied kid.
What were you bullied for?
Oh, because I'm not, like, you know, all the typical stuff. I wasn't into sports. Except baseball. I loved baseball. Mm-hmm. I really wasn't into sports, and I played the piano and stuff. So I just wasn't like a guy's guy in junior high school. You know, so I did. I was a pretty good cartoonist. And I used to draw cartoons. One of the things that I realize now in retrospect, so I only had like one friend, Steve Flashner. Are you out there, Steve?
I don't think your friends showed up. A couple of your friends showed up.
Yeah. So
they wanted to come.
To this day.
I talked to Steve. He couldn't make it.
And so Steve was kind of like my only friend, except the big kid behind us who I played catch with every day. But Steve was like the kid at school who was my friend. And I, at some point, I lied to him, and I said, you know, I he would see me draw these cartoons, and he'd say, "Boy, those are really good." You know, I'd say, "Well, you know, I'm a cartoonist I made this up for the Peoria Life newspaper." I figured, like, who's gonna fact check, right? And he was like, "Really?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, I got a big deadline. I gotta go do a cartoon." And I, like, this was my friend, not like some jerk who I lied to. And I never told him the truth. I mean, to this day, he probably thinks I was
why
a cartoonist
you,
for the Peoria
Why do you think
life.
You lied to him then,
I
when you look
know.
Back at it?
I mean, I think I needed to feel like important or successful at something. And you would think you would prove that to, like, some kid who was being mean to you, right? And you wanted to, like, turn him around. But, like, I was probably not even on their radar. At least that this kid would talk to me.
Right. I'm thinking if I was going to lie, I wouldn't say a Peoria paper. I'd say, like, the New York Times.
Which he also probably wouldn't fact check.
Exactly.
But I think I was smart enough to realize that, like, it was no internet. You know, how's he going to find out that there's no Peoria Life?
You also said, you talked about starting theater, and your first show was 1984. What happened during one of your performances?
Okay, so I tried out for every sport, you know, in high school, and I lasted like one day in each sport, and just like, oh no, this can I do
you? You can swear. This is
like fuck this. Yeah. I just quit.
Right.
You know, this is not for me.
Right.
Right. Now my kids can't listen to this podcast.
Right. You've never sworn at Channel 11 on air, right? You can't do that.
No.
Okay.
No, but...
So here's the time. Just this whatever you... any...
Fabulous. That's
right.
Great.
Good.
I was going to swear, but...
Okay.
What was the question? Oh, yeah. So, no, I tried out for every sport. And actually, I loved baseball. So I'm giving a big preamble. I loved baseball. And I was really, at certain times, I was pretty good at baseball. Not good enough to be, like, on the high school team. Did done a lot of Little League. And so I tried out for baseball, and they made me the manager. You know what the manager does? The equipment manager, right? Like, you go, you put down the bases, you, you know, you carry the bats. And talk about being bullied. Like, you are just the, you are mercilessly bullied by all these jocks, right? As because, like, who would do this except some schlub, you know? And I remember I was just, it finally became intolerable. I stayed the whole season, and the last game, right before the last game of the season, I went up to the coach and I said, I just can't stand this anymore, I quit. And the coach looked at me and he said, if you stay one more game, you're going to get your letter. Don't you want your letter? And I'm like, first of all, I didn't know I was going to get a letter. And second of all, I was like, I couldn't care less about getting a letter. I'm like, really? Do you think I actually? So I quit. So sophomore year, I walked into drama club. And it couldn't have been more different. It was like, okay, here's my tribe, right? They were like, come on in. Watch that guy. He's really funny. You know, sure, we'll put you in the show. You know, and if you were, if you sucked, you know, they would, like, help you. You know, oh, okay, no. Here's how you do that. It's much funnier, much better if you do. It was like everybody was so supportive, you know. And it was a really great group of people, like, really great group of people, like, very creative, smart. So I just felt like I found where I belong. So, and the way that the drama club was set up at Deerfield High School in the 1970s, was you really had to earn your stripes. You had to do some plays in drama club before you could go on the main stage. You know, like, they really had it. This is good for high school kids. You know, they had it set up where you had to kind of earn your...
Was it competitive, or...?
It wasn't like... See, that's interesting. No, I don't think it... I mean, I'm sure it was. Mm-hmm. But there, I never felt any, like...
Because you were having such a good time?
Yeah, it was just like, oh, okay, I got to do this before I'm good enough to do that. You had to pay your dues.
Right.
And I, that was very smart of the way that... that her name was Irene Kramsky, Mrs. K. I mean, she just passed away.
Have you, do you always... Because when you watch you on television, you're like tons of... You just admit facts, you know, like, you're just facts just fall out of your mouth. Have you always had that ability? Because you're picking up people's names from 30 years ago.
You know what's
ago.
Really funny? My wife, Amelia, would tell you, if it's like some friend of ours, I won't remember their name. I won't remember that I've ever met them. I won't remember their kids' names or that, like, one of their kids has leukemia or something.
No, that's not
I mean,
important.
I won't remember any of that. But if it has to do with, like, Daniel Burnham or Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, that's what
Does
she always
Does she get annoyed about that? She
Extremely
must go.
Extremely annoyed. Are you kidding? You've met him before.
Right.
So.
Do you correct?
You've met him. You know. But anyway.
Does she ever tell you, like, shut up, I don't want to hear any more facts? Does she ever say that?
No.
Okay.
She loves facts. She loves, tell me more facts, really.
That's what attracted her to you,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah. You know so many facts.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so So I was in drama club, and we were doing these little... And the way it worked was that the senior kids would direct the freshman kids, you know, which was also great. So we were doing this play, a production of 1984.
One of my favorites, 1984.
It's a good play. And it was, and actually, the one of the people in the play was a very successful Chicago playwright now named Douglas Post.
Okay.
Who's done really well, and he's still a good friend of mine. He's in Chicago. But anyway, I was... O'Brien, who's the torturer, and he was Winston, who, if you know 1984, you know, they're trying to brainwash him. It's like thought control over the whole society. And Winston is a dissident and doesn't want, and I hope I'm getting the names right. I could have been Winston and he could have been O'Brien, but I'm pretty sure he was Winston.
Well,
no, he was.
We've got a fact checker, so don't worry about it.
Anyway, so, no, he was Winston.
Right.
So the way you know, he was imprisoned, we were trying to brainwash him and get him to come over to our side, and the way you get him to come over to your side is if anything you say, he'll agree with. So what I'm saying to Winston is I'm trying to get him to say 2 + 2 = 5, right? And I would... And we also found out that Winston was terrified of rats. So they're in the play, they're torturing him with rats. And then every few minutes, O'Brien, or every hour, O'Brien comes in and he leans in and he says, how many fingers am I holding up, Winston? And Winston says, 4. And, you know, and I go off and more rats come in, and then then I come back out, how many fingers Winston? Of course, we were doing with British accents. How many fingers Winston? You know, and four. And I would go out. And we had made rat sound effects. We got an old reel-to-reel tape recorder and a shoebox. And we were like, did this on the shoebox. We all went, you know, to make rat sound of terrifying rat sound effects. And so, you know, the lights would go down. The lights would come up. How many fingers, Winston? Four. You know, and finally, I came out, you know, and actually, my chair was like this. You know, I'm sitting
Turn
backwards
around,
on the chair. How many fingers, Winston? And it was Doug Post. And he finally gives, you know, he says, five. And I looked at him, and I couldn't remember my next line to save my life. And I lean into Doug, and I say, what's the next line? And Doug says, I don't know. And I said, I think you need some more work, Winston. And I just went off stage. Like the ultimate like improv crowd. You leave the guy alone on stage.
Right.
And I'm like, turn the rats back on. And they turned on the rats.
And what were you
and
thinking?
And I'm going through the script like, what the fuck is my line? And I found my line. And then I came running back out on stage and I... Doug must have been like, what am I doing out here? I'm alone on stage.
What did he say to you afterwards?
That was okay, Jeff. Don't worry about it. Okay. I mean, it was.
Did you feel bad about it?
I felt.
I mean, that'd be the most embarrassing.
It was. No, that was not the most embarrassing.
What was the most embarrassing?
Oh, I don't know.
No,
I mean,
there have been so many
disasters. But I would have to think. What was more embarrassing than that? But obviously, I felt horrible leaving him out there on stage by himself.
But you liked it enough to continue theater.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
And so then you end up studying theater in college, right?
A little bit. I majored in radio, TV, film because I guess, I don't know. I didn't think theater was, I was going to really be able to like have a viable life in theater. And I actually, the other thing is that I've only just recently figured out is, I think I told you this backstage, I never had any intention to be an on-camera person or a performer. I loved performing, but I always loved the process way more. I loved rehearsals, and you know, performing was kind of like the payoff, but I loved the whole process, and I particularly loved everything that went on behind the scenes. Like, I loved the lighting, I loved the sound, I loved like how you make a set, I loved all that stuff. And my interest in radio, TV, film, I think, was like cameras and editing rooms and how we make all that stuff, you know? And I never set out to be a performer or on camera. So anyway, that's, I think, was also why I chose to major in radio, TV, film.
Well, how does it feel to be like you're one of the faces of Channel 11 now?
You know, I feel very lucky to do what I do. I feel very lucky to do what I do. But honestly, I've never been comfortable with it. People walk up to me, like this happened out here in the lobby just before the show, and it happened three times earlier today. It always surprises me. It always catches me off guard. I always feel a little like, oh, was I picking my nose? I better smile, you know. Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you that you like my work. And I suppose I would be, you know, I better be worried if people aren't coming up to me and telling me that. But it's always like a little off-putting when somebody comes up and says, oh, I saw you on TV, and I love what you do, and it's weird. It's weird. I've never gotten comfortable with it.
Well, I get uncomfortable when people come up to me and say, are you on Channel 11?
Yeah, sure. Do people really say that?
I am serious. I'm totally serious. Yeah. You're my doppelganger, or I'm your doppelganger.
Well, you know, we have another guy at Channel 11. His name is Jay Shefsky, who is also on the air. And we have, like, parallel lives. When I was at Deerfield High School, he was at Evanston Township High School. I directed the big variety show at Deerfield. He directed the big variety show at Evanston Township High School. And over our years at TTW, we have, you know, he's lost all his hair. I've lost all my hair. And people are constantly coming up to me like, oh, Jay, I love your Jay's Chicago. Or they're coming up to Jay and saying, oh, Jeffrey, you know, I've got a question for Ask Jeffrey on Channel 11. So that is funny that maybe it's just, who do you ever see who's bald, you know, performing anywhere, really, except a villain?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So.
So you So you graduate, and then you go to Philadelphia to do television.
Yeah, I had an early television. I got out of undergrad, and I worked in TV and radio kind of in several markets around the country. I ended up in Philadelphia.
And then you come back here to study theater at Northwestern.
Right. Well, so I had gotten out of grad school, I mean, out of undergrad, and I was just, like, sending resumes out everywhere. Like, I had no sense of, like, well, what should I do? I mean, I could have ended up being, like, the afternoon radio news guy in Omaha. You know, I applied for every kind of job there was. And there used to be a trade magazine called Broadcasting Magazine. They would have weekly want-ins, and I would just send out, you know, I was working at the radio station in my college town and just sending out the. So I made commercials in Cincinnati. And then there was this series called PM Magazine that was kind of syndicated nationally, and did that in Michigan, and I ended up doing that in Philadelphia. So, you know, I was doing pretty well. I had about 5 years. I was moving up the ladder really quickly, television.
You would have had a really, I mean, if you stayed that path, you would have, I mean, it would have been huge TV, right? Don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, most of the people who I worked with in Philadelphia ended up, I actually often feel like it was a pretty good move for me to get out of that, because most of those people went on to do a kind of TV that I'm just not interested in. They were mostly doing, what do you call those kind of shows? You know, like Entertainment Tonight and what are they? I don't even watch these shows. But, you know, Inside Edition, I mean, these kinds of like, you know,
the tabloidy thing.
Tabloid yeah. TV. Thank right. you. So they all ended up kind of going on to do tabloid TV.
But you decide you're going to screw this.
Right.
I'm coming to do.
Well, I'd been doing theater too. I was doing theater in Philly while mm-hmm. I was doing this TV gig, and I was like, you know, this is going really well, this TV thing, and if it keeps on going like this, I'll probably never get back into the theater, which is kind of where my roots were. And I also thought, you know, maybe I'll, this local TV thing isn't getting me towards, like, doing feature film or sitcoms, which is kind of what I thought I wanted to
act in them or write them?
Probably write and direct.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, I'm going to go back to the roots. I'm going to go back to Northwestern. They've got a great theater program. Plus, I mean, I really didn't think it through, but I could live with my folks, so I don't have to rent. You know, I can move back to Chicago. I can get a graduate assistantship, so I don't have tuition. You know, so it was kind of like I could do this without a big financial burden that I couldn't really sustain. So I came back and I did it. It turns out Northwestern was like this great program.
And that is where you get introduced to improvisation with some Viola Spolin games.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. At Northwestern, what I've always said about Northwestern was a great program, but they didn't teach beginning acting. They started you off beyond beginning acting. B-43, which is the first, I think B-43. Any Northwestern people out there?
We can fact check
that. The first acting class at Northwestern is not beginning acting. And they did teach the Spolin games I think I had a Spolin book in graduate school, Improvisation for the Theater. But when I got out of Northwestern, I sort of stumbled into teaching at the High School for the Arts. One of my professors at Northwestern was married to the head of the theater program at the High School for the Arts. They needed a part-time teacher. Ha ha, no such thing as a part-time teacher your first year teaching. So I was trying to finish up my degree and teach part-time. And I ended up staying there 5 years, and what I discovered was I was going back to all these sources that I had learned in graduate school, one of which was the Spolin book. And I figured out, I had this laboratory of these kids, these high school kids, every day for an hour and a half, 2 hours a day.
That's a long time.
It was a long time, and I was able to start sort of integrating and understanding and processing all this stuff that I just didn't understand at all when I was in grad school. And a lot of that was Stanislavski and Spolin, both of them. Stanislavski, because of action, which is the thing, the beginning thing that nobody taught, at least me, at Northwestern, which is, what are you doing? And what is the opposing force against you that's preventing you from getting what you want? So you don't go at an, you don't act in emotion. Emotions will come when you understand who your character is and you understand what you're trying to get and what is getting in your way. The emotions will take care of themselves. You don't act in emotion.
To simplify it, is what does the character want? You're fighting for their wants.
What do you want? And what's the opposing force against you, right? And then if you kind of have worked on understanding the kind of character you are and how you intersect with that character, the emotions should just take care of themselves, at least in my view. And the Spolin games were like a huge component of my work. And you get to do, you know, every day I'd play these Spolin games with my students. And you'd kind of see, oh, because she's not, Viola Spolin was not actually a very good writer. And so, but by playing the games, you go, oh, that's what she was trying to, that's what she meant. You know, it took a while, you know, to kind of understand what she meant by virtue of these games.
So you're doing that, you're teaching that, and then you've completed Northwestern, and how did you become an associate producer at WTTW?
So the school I taught at, the High School for the Arts, Chicago Academy for the Arts, back then, which we're talking 84 to 89, I'm old, it was so amazingly rich in terms of the experience with the kids, but it was the most dysfunctional place on earth. I mean, it was so dysfunctional. And the faculty were, there were a lot of troubled people on the faculty and troubled students. It was a troubled place. And it was great, but my fifth year there, it had really clearly become like, well, I can't do this for my career. It was just, well, first of all, there's no money. But it was just, it was not going to be my career. So I started thinking about getting back into TV. Somebody who I intersected with at the Academy was like a freelancer at WTTW. And said, well, you know, talk to WTTW. You know, they're building this arts unit over there. And I had this odd background for television. I had this arts background, but also this TV production background, which made me a little unusual. And I went over and I interviewed. And actually, my boss told me, the guy who ultimately hired me, who went on to be the head of arts programming for PBS, told me, he was a very funny guy. And he, in the course of this interview, he referred to himself and all of us at TTW as TV sluts, and which was like something he used to say. And in my letter, you know, you always write a letter after your interview, right, to sort of say, oh, how much I enjoyed interviewing you and how much I would like to work there. And I said, your comments about whoremongering notwithstanding, I'd still like to work with you. And he told me again and again, the word whoremongering was what got me that job. Like the fact that I put whoremongering in the letter.
That's a good lesson for people out there. Put whoremonger. Always put whoremonger.
Whoremonger will get you the job every time.
All right, so we're going to improvise.
Okay.
Okay, and you've said that you believe improv is not only an art form, but also a philosophy of life.
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain that before we...
you may not see this in the improvisation we do, but I don't think of... When I found improv, it was like a revelation. You know, I'm not actually interested particularly. Well, I'm not. Obviously not. I have no personal interest in pursuing, you know, getting on Saturday Night Live. It's way too late for that anyway. But I never would have anyway. I'm not actually interested in improv as like a ha-ha comedy form. In fact, I taught improv for many years at Players Workshop of Second City, where you and I both have studied. And I would always say, like, the first day of class, I would say to my students, I have one rule in this class. Don't try to be funny. And they would look at me like, what are you talking about? I thought that's why I'm here, you know, was to learn how to be funny. You know, and I'm like, well, first of all, you'll have no hope of being funny if you're trying to be, because you won't be, you'll be, like, in your head constantly. You won't even be listening to what's going on with the other person. You'll just be trying to make a joke. Which is interestingly what my dad was always doing. He was trying to turn everything into a joke. So I was trying to, like, correct my childhood.
I'm glad you figured it out.
Yeah. Jimmy, thank you
so much. You're welcome,
Jeffrey.
You're welcome.
Oh, my God. This is going to change my life.
Yeah.
Sorry to the audio guy for doing that. It's about just looking at the other person and listening to the other person and letting what's going to happen in the space between you happen. And it's not something you could do by yourself, and it's not something the other person could do. Well, that's like, you can take that out into the world, right? I mean, that's a pretty good way to live your life, you know? And I never achieve it in real life, but or rarely do. But I think it's like super healthy, you know? And I think it's a great thing.
About it, because you haven't improvised in 20 years.
Over 20 years, okay. Except we did a little practicing right before we started. But it felt that we practiced a little bit, and I felt like, oh, okay, I kind of remember how to do this. But no, I feel pretty not too great about doing this.
Well, I appreciate you doing this because it's like really brave to do it, you know?
Oh, thank you.
All right. And this thing about not being funny, do we want to bring that into the improv and see how that would work?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to try to be funny.
Okay, great.
This is going to suck.
Okay, great.
You'll be like, how much did you pay for this? I don't even know.
But it's really good to manage their expectations.
Yeah, yes, that's
really
good.
This
is that will something? Not be funny.
Right, right. Is that something you learned at public television to manage people's expectations?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
For sure. At every level.
Especially during pledge drive.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take a suggestion. What would you like as a suggestion?
I liked what we talked about. A place that would fit on the stage.
Place that would fit on a stage. An elevator.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Now you're laughing. Because what are you thinking about in terms of elevator when they gave you that suggestion that you laughed about it?
Like, we're not going to have very much room to play.
Okay. All right. Well, we don't have to stay on the elevator.
No,
right.
I know. That's true. Okay. Right. That's how you just, like, completely subvert the audience's suggestion. You're like, bing, here we are. And then you're like, totally, that was the elevator.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So, elevator. They gave us elevator.
Elevator. All right.
It's not working, Bill. The elevator, it's not working today.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So you're just going to have to wait right there, okay, until I get clearance.
I have a really important meeting on the 75th floor. Mm-hmm. You know I have this meeting every week on the 75th floor. What, I'm going to walk?
That's what Mr. Carlson did. He walked up 42 flights of stairs. He got here at 6:30.
I didn't get that text.
I'm not going to take a bribe from you. I can't. A lot of stuff's going on in the city, and I'm not going to be part of the problem.
Okay, I'm going to...
Bill, now, I don't want to taser you, okay? I'm not afraid to. It's not working. I told you that. Stairs are working.
Do you have any sense of why it's not working?
I can't divulge that information at this time.
Is it the same reason as last week?
Could be, Bill.
That's just because you didn't want to let anybody on the elevator. I know you like to do this. You like to torture me. You've liked to torture me since the day we started at Burdick Industries. You've liked to torture me. Now, I just need to get to the meeting. Really. I didn't mean to get that promotion. Okay?
You think it's about the promotion?
Of course it's about the promotion.
Bill, please, stand right there, please. You know, that could be one of the reasons.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, and the other reason?
Holidays come. It comes every year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
people during the holidays usually give other people gifts that they know, that they've worked with, you know, for 10, 15 years.
And this is not a bribe?
No, like, it's not a bribe.
I know how sensitive you are about the idea.
I will not take a bribe, no.
Well, I just, the only reason I didn't give you the same fifth of Chablis that I gave everyone else is because I know that you would interpret it as a bribe. But it just so happens right here in this bag, I have, and look at the ribbon. You like the ribbon?
Yeah, I like the ribbon.
So, you know, if I were to be able to get on that elevator, this could be yours. And you know, Chablis, a fifth of Chablis is rare because Chablis never comes in fifths, right? So at Sotheby's, this could really bring in a lot of money.
Are you offering me that as the holiday gift?
Oh, it's strictly a holiday gift.
Okay.
Strictly. There
well,
you go.
Thank you.
No problem.
So that makes up for last year.
Okay, what I'm going to let you do here is just close your eyes. Close your eyes. I'm going to let you reach in.
This is like a grab bag or something?
It is a grab bag. This is for this year.
Okay.
I'm going to let you reach in here and
reach in there.
But you got to close your eyes.
Got to close my eyes.
Yeah, actually.
I don't know if I can close my eyes. I'm on duty.
Oh. Hey. It's in the bag. You know, think about it. Just close your eyes.
Okay.
Say yes, man. Close your eyes.
Okay, I will. I'll.
Hey, it's really not working. How'd you get up to the 75th floor so fast?
We're not on the 75th floor. This is the first floor.
Oh. Yeah, it is. There's Marty in the lobby.
Yeah.
Hey, Marty, you want a fifth of Chablis?
Wow! How'd that feel? How did that feel? You won't see that on Chicago tonight. Though I have to say, Phil Ponce. He's a very funny guy off stage, isn't he?
He is.
You don't really see that when he's interviewed.
Oh, he can be. He can be funny on TV? Well, if it's called for.
TV funny.
Yeah, TV. He has the skill that I've never had, which is he can totally keep a straight face and just, like, you know, ask you a question that's really funny.
Right.
Which I've never been able to do.
Do you want to cut up more on TV, like be a little more funny? Do you feel like you're holding yourself back sometimes?
No. Okay. I like it's like a character that I didn't realize this, but there is kind of what I am on TV is kind of like a character.
How is he different than you in real life?
I'm an asshole in real life.
Is that true?
No, that's not true. I tried to make a joke. See, it's bad. Bad. I violated my own rule.
What is the difference?
It's like more in it. I suppose any character that you play is like sort of you
heightened
times two.
Right.
So it's like a heightened me. I want to actually get back to your question, though. You said, how did that feel?
Yes,
so
I'd love to know about it.
This is so funny. I had my back to the audience for, like, the first half of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really preoccupied with the fact that my back was to the audience. And because I thought, we went where we were going. I thought I was going to just walk in and push the button and get on the elevator. And you decided to block my way. So I was preoccupied a lot of the time with trying to open myself up to the audience, and because I'm like, this is like, they're gonna, partly I think because I thought you might be thinking I was doing that because I was so uncomfortable improvising.
So you were kind of like self-conscious about this
thing? Yeah, I was, and I was feeling like, I bet they think I'm hiding from them by keeping my back to the audience. So then I tried a couple of times to, like, open up the audience, but you thought I was trying to get to the elevator.
Yes.
And you kept blocking my way.
Yes.
And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go with this because there's no way I'm going to get myself turned around.
I thought it was great because you were going out of the audience and I went to follow you. And then all of a sudden, you turned really quickly, and then it gave me a huge gift because I'm like, I'm blocking the elevator,
yeah.
You know? And then all of a sudden we had this, like, really great relationship.
You used a great term, which is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you use that in your teaching, but I use that in my teaching all the time. Like, it is a very helpful term, because if you're trying to get people to stop thinking they have a better idea than you do, you know, it's like you are giving someone a gift by what you initiate. So take the gift, you know, accept the gift, which I guess at first I was having a hard time accepting. I guess you said I gave you the gift.
Yeah, because all of a sudden there was tension. There was like, okay, these guys have history. And the thing that I liked about it is we started to discover it was, you know, this guy had some resentments towards this guy. And probably, you know, like, here was the day that he was going to block the elevator.
Yeah.
Probably really didn't work. And then you discovered it. And then We kind of fumbled towards the end.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, I don't know how I could justify getting up.
Yeah, you started running.
Right. And then I'm like, okay, well, that kind of didn't make sense. But then you had also said in the elevator that...
it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. So right. Then I was like, okay, let's go with what you had said and just...
Yeah, and I saw you running.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, I guess I am on the 75th floor.
Okay.
So it was like we were in different realities there.
Yeah, but we made it work, you know, because it came down to agreement. Anything you would have done differently besides
having myself open to the audience, like maybe facing the audience? Well, you know, the other thing, you were talking about like this memory that I have, which would be extremely funny to my wife. But I, one of the main things that I'm really bad at is I cannot remember people's names. And I think you gave me a name at some point, and I think I even gave you a name. Was I Marty? Who? Somebody was Marty, weren't they? Anyway,
I don't.
And I'm like halfway through the scene. I'm like, I think he called me by a name, and I think I might have called him by name, and I couldn't remember what the name was. So I couldn't use your name in the scene. Like I couldn't say, "Come on, Marty," because I didn't remember what your name was, which I had given you.
Right.
You know.
What were the names, you guys? What were the names?
Bill.
Mr. Carlson and Bill.
Okay.
And I even came up with a good name for the. For the company we worked for, that I forgot that too. So, what is it? Burdick Industries. I thought maybe we'd go somewhere with that. Right. I don't know, but so that was bad. I mean, like I'm like, shit. I gave him a name, and now I don't remember the name, and so I can't use your name. And we're supposed to be these two people who know each other and have this big rivalry. So that's a good note.
That happens to me all the time. You know, and my trick is just keep repeating the name.
Yeah.
You know, until you get it. All right, we're going to take some questions and answers from the audience.
Okay.
Okay, you ready?
Well, they are going to answer the questions too.
If you could answer them, I'd really appreciate it. Great. So if we could turn the lights up, Sam, and who's question right here, Tom. That is a question. That is a Chicago question. And why does Ogden Avenue come to?
Do you really want me to answer?
Yes.
Are you talking about it over at Halsted?
Well, no, it's further west, like just past right around Chicago, Milwaukee, that area.
Right. Oh, actually, no. I'm thinking farther back in history. So Ogden used to be on a big viaduct and fly up over and. Over the river, and it dumped out. It continued on the viaduct through what is now Cabrini Green, and then it went down to street level. And if you go to Clark and Armitage, you will notice that there's a bunch of buildings there on a diagonal that don't face a street; they face a park. And that park used to be Ogden. So Ogden used to come all the way to Clark and Armitage. And I think, as with so many things in our city, you know, then they built Cabrini Green, and I think they were trying to, you know, you can make a case that a lot of the highways were built to keep people away from other people, and I think they tore down that viaduct when it was going to pass through Cabrini Green and be like a way for people to get from Cabrini Green into Lincoln Park. I think they didn't want that. And they tore that down. When I used to teach at the High School for the Arts, I would drive from Lincoln Park up down Halsted, and that viaduct was still there, but it hadn't been used in years. It like dead-ended above Halsted, and then they finally tore it down.
Great, another question.
I actually knew the answer to that question.
Yes?
So we're talking about improv, obviously.
Yeah. Sure I do, but I can't think of any right now. But, you know, they always have their prompter copy in front of them. Okay. Phil always has his physical prompter copy. And in fact, last week when we were doing Ask Jeffrey, when we were doing another bit on Chicago Tonight, it was a little more improvised than Ask Jeffrey usually is on Chicago Night. This is a bit where people write in with their questions about Chicago architecture and history, and I answer them. And usually it's pretty scripted out beforehand. This one wasn't. And so the guy who runs the prompter didn't know where we were. And we were pre-recording it, so it wouldn't have really mattered. But, you know, it's a union crew, and there's not a whole lot of time, and you don't want to have to do it again if you don't have to. And so I saw that for the first time. Phil, we got to the end of it, and the prompter guy just had no idea where we were. And Phil, I just saw Phil just look right down at his paper and, like, didn't miss a beat, just started reading the concluding copy with the outro. And he kept looking up at the camera, and eventually the prompter guy caught up with him, and then he just locked his eyes on the camera and kept. I was really impressed with that. I'm always impressed with those people who do live shots, because they usually have something scripted out that they're going to say, and it's live news, you know? And they're really good at like saying what it is they have to say, you know? And it's a fair amount of copy, and then leading it, because the control room is waiting for you to give the cue to go to whatever pre-recorded thing they're going to. But I think news people are pretty good at that, but it's certainly by the time they get to Chicago. They
great.
Are.
Another question right over here.
Did you ever try your hand at musical improv, and do you remember a parody song of your father's?
Did you ever try your hand at musical improv?
No, I never tried my hand at musical improv. I've always felt that musical improv is so difficult. It is so, that and improvising Shakespeare, which I've seen both. And I'm so in awe of people who can do musical improv. Because I'm very musical, but they can just nail it, like Sondheim, and they nail like a Sondheim tune. They just get it, I would never be able to do that, you know? But sure, oh yeah, I remember lots of my.
Give us one.
Well, he did. See, now I'm going to blank on the. We were at his 90th birthday party. We sang a bunch of his song parodies that we got. Some of them are not parodies. He also really loves wordplay, and he did this commercial for Play-Doh Plovers, Plastic Plumbers Plungers, pledges pleasing plunging in platter planer plush. And he wrote like, and it might have been a parody. Plato, Plovers, Plastic Plumbers, Plungers, Pledges, Pleasing, Plunging, and Platter, Planer, Plush. And I remember that one. I remember, it is for 6 months we've eaten cheese. Yeah, for 6 months we've eaten cheese, not a single thing but cheese. It's a diet we found in a magazine. Then he lists all the cheeses because he loves words. And da 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 da, Camembert, Swiss rye, da da, Camembert. Da, 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 da. And we can't help but wonder why we're bound, why we're bound. We can't help but wonder why we're bound.
He was very Borscht Belty, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Oh, yeah. And he just loves words. He loves, like, there's no word big enough for him. And names. He loves to make up names, like crazy names, like Potiphar. And not make them up, but, like, you know, find, like, really ridiculous names. And he sends out a Christmas poem every year. He sends out, you know, we're Jewish, right? He sends out a Christmas poem every year. And it's always based on the night before Christmas. And it's topical. So I do remember one year, it was the last, it's good. And I got to remember because it's too funny not to say the right It was basically the year Jimmy Hoffa disappeared, and it was they figured out where Jimmy Hoffa had gone. He was picketing the last non-union Teamster up at the North Pole.
What can we expect this year?
I don't know. I never know till it comes out.
All right. Another question. Yes.
Versus teaching high school?
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved teaching at Players Workshop because a lot of these people were, one of the ways Players Workshop used to make money was companies, like particularly ad agencies, would subsidize their employees to go take like improv classes. So it was often a lot of like business professionals who had no history with theater or acting at all, you know, and that's also, I always taught the first year kids at high school too. I just really liked getting people who had no basis in this, no experience with it at all.
What did you like about that?
Power. No. Actually, that's one of the things, one of my pet peeves about acting teachers is power craze, like this little world, and they want to, you know, be like your guru, you know, which I just cannot take. I think it's, you know, I always used to say I took a very subtractive approach to teaching acting. Like, it may not be what you think it is. What I think everybody can act. And my job is to get out of the way all the misconceptions you have about what you think acting is, to get at what you just can do naturally if you just forget that what you think acting is something else. Like, I think I'm supposed to perform, you know. I just want to get you to see that, you know, Bud Beyer at Northwestern had this really great exercise.
He was a teacher there?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had this great exercise, which is he would have his kids working on a scene, and he'd say, my goal is if I walk past the room hearing you work on a scene, it should not sound to me like you're acting. It should sound to me like you're really
like
having
we're
a real conversation. Not like you're acting with each other, right? and so, like, one of the things I always would do my first day of class is I would send two students. I was also good at, like, trying to sort of size up who the students were early on. And my two first exercises were a game was based on the old TV show To Tell the Truth, right? And I would sit them all in a circle, and I would say, write down on a piece of paper, something about yourself that's we could ask two questions about that you're sure nobody else in this room knows. And I'd get all these things, and I'd have three people stand up, and I'd say one of the three people in this room used to be a state trooper, or whatever the question was, right? Your job is to convince everybody in the circle to vote for you. Well, that's all I would say. You will naturally solve that problem by not acting, because the more you act, the more you're going to give yourself away. That it's not you, right? You're going to try to be as natural as possible, right? And I would even say, because this was a true one, who was one of these people was a state trooper. If the question then is, well, what kind of radar did you use in your radar gun, right? If you say, oh, well, we used number 76 Megatron radar, you know, I mean, you could totally give yourself away. The answer might be, a pretty good answer might be like, you know what, I don't know. I just knew how to operate the machine, but I don't know what it was. Because that actually was what the real state trooper said. He had no clue what kind of radar it was. He just knew how to operate the machine, right? So that was one exercise. And the other exercise was I would take the hammy. After I did that, I kind of figure out who the hammiest person in class was, like the biggest. And I would find the hammiest person in class. And I would say, go up on stage. They'd get up on stage, go, act grossed out. And they would just act, you know, like they'd chew the scenery.
I'm
and
so
I'm just
grossed
like,
out.
Oh, yeah, you know. And then I would come up on stage with this bag that had, like, stuff dripping out of the bottom of it. And I'd say, put your hand in this bag. And they'd put their hand in that bag, and you would see the most real. Because I had, like, wet, greasy spaghetti in that bag, like, that I had then refrigerated, you know. And it just was like sticking your hand in brains, you know. And you would see on their face, like, they, just the fear of even reaching in the bag, right? And then I would just say to the students, so he did it one way, and then he did it another way, which one looked, was more, you know, real, which one looked more grossed out. And they, you'd see them on their faces, them go like, oh, you know. So I loved that. I loved, you know, kind of like trying to shatter misconceptions.
So we're going
to
bring that bag right out now. This has been great, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. But before we go, we ask a question. It's the same question we ask at the end of all our episodes.
Oh, I'm glad I've never listened to one.
Great.
No, kidding.
Don't worry about it. I've seen all your specials. Okay. What is one thing you would tell somebody starting out in improv today? One piece of advice.
Well, first of all, let me start by saying I get interviewed a lot, and people love this question of, like, what's your favorite thing Or what was the thing you learned the most? And I always hate these questions because I'm very bad at like coming up with like sort of one thing. So let me give that a good moment to think about. What is one thing? I don't know. Can I just say what I already said?
It's your question.
Don't try to be funny. Cardinal rule, do not try to be funny. You'll kill it.
Any tips on not being funny? Any tips that you've learned along the way that you can?
Oh, I really know how not to be funny. No. Okay. you just really need to let go of your own ego and listen and trust and wait and give a gift, you know? Give that gift. Don't try to be funny. Give somebody a gift.
So when you had someone in class, the hammy person or the person that's like, stop it. This is the sixth week and you're still trying to be funny. What would you tell that student to?
You know, Will Klinger, Will is a famous Chicago guy in the improv and comedy world, and I taught with him once at Players Workshop, and he had this great phrase. He would see something happen, he would stop. I got to throw a flag on that one. And he would throw a flag. I don't know, maybe he got it from you. Right. But it was like foul. It's like, that's a foul, you know? I mean, I guess if it was really severe, I might try to make... You usually solve problems with a game, mm-hmm. right? So you can try to make a game out of it. You can say, you can restrict what they're allowed to do in some way. Like if they're always trying to be funny, right? You might say, every time you hear them try to make a joke, everybody go, you know, and then you have to say something else instead. Or every time we stop you, we need to back up the scene from that point and start it again and see if you make a different choice. I don't know, that might be a little too cruel, you know, like pointing at a mistake. So maybe I'd try to find a different game where your role always had to be to get, you can only initiate. The only thing you can do in the scene is initiate. You can only give things. It's maybe we're doing a scene where it's all about giving. You can only give. You can't receive. You can only give. No matter what happens in the scene, you can only give.
I think that's really valuable about, like, give them an exercise. Because I think sometimes students get really frustrated when you say, stop trying to be funny or do it this way. But if you give them an exercise that they can do.
Well, give them something to do. Yeah. Right. Give them something to do. I was very lucky in my first class at Players Workshop. There was Eric Forsberg was in my class.
Eric, of course, is the son of Josephine Forsberg, yeah. Who started Players.
He was born in improv, right? And for some reason, he was taking the class. He might have been training to teach, and I learned so much from just watching that guy. There was nothing that could happen in a scene that he wouldn't make a part of the scene. You know what I mean? There was just... You would say things like, this is not an exact example, but it's what comes to mind. You know, you always say to say yes. Obviously, we all know that. So you could walk out on that stage, and you would have a toaster. Let's say you had a toaster, right? And you would say, look, I just bought a new toaster. And then some improv person who wasn't very experienced would go, that's not a toaster, that's a watermelon, right? Like just completely negating... And he wouldn't lose a beat. He'd go, yes, it's a watermelon toaster. Watch this. The seeds pop out. I mean, he would just like, okay, I said it was a toaster. You said it's a watermelon. So we're in some way, we're in a world where a toaster could be mistaken for a watermelon. And he would make it part of the scene. Isn't it great? Yes, look, they're making toasters now that look like watermelons. No, that's really a toaster. Okay. You know, I mean, he would just make it part of the scene. No matter what happened. And that, as much as any teacher could have taught me, just watching that was like, whoa, that is really varsity.
Jeffrey Baer, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank from Channel 11 WTTW here in Chicago, our guest, Jeffrey Baer. And I love the story he talked about with his grandmother, and she said, you know, someday you'll be on television. I think that was just such a cool story. I also want to thank Stage 773 here, our home base, the people who treat us so kindly and like rock stars. Also, my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. For more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning workshops and classes here in Chicago, the Art of Slow Comedy, or if you want me to come to you to teach my award-winning workshops and classes, you can go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also, follow us on social media. Like our Improv Nerd Facebook page. Also, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and go to our wonderful YouTube channel. Dan Schiffmacher's done such a great job in putting this together, and that is on YouTube. That's just Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word. We're lucky to be part of a podcast collective called feralaudio.com. They have some of the most unique and innovative and hilarious podcast out there right now, so check out feralaudio.com. I'd like to thank both our sponsors today, Mick Napier's new book, Behind the Scenes, Improvising Long Form. You can get it at the Annoyance Theater in Chicago or online at Amazon.com. Also, the Houston Improv Festival. Submissions are now open through January 31st. Just go to HoustonImprovFestival.com/submissions. And of course, you. Without you, I couldn't do this. Thanks for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck